Welcome back to the Global Greek Influence Podcast. I'm Panayota Pinnenidou. To be up to date with news from the Global Greek Influence Podcast and suggest your topics, subscribe, like, and review the Global Greek Influence Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Anchor FM, and four more podcasting platforms. You can contact the Global Greek Influence with the podcast, Facebook, and Twitter accounts, the podcast website, globalgreekinfluence.com, and LinkedIn page. My guest today is Dr. Fotis Philippopoulos, an innovation management expert, a corporate innovation specialist, an advisor at the European Commission in Innovation, an International Hellenic University visiting professor, and a visiting lecturer at the School of the Politecnico di Milano, and an MIT innovation-driven entrepreneurship educator. He is also the Curious INC founder and PhD holder from the University of Greenwich. In 2017, Fotis was awarded the Mark of Excellence for Best Provision of Industry Information and Intelligence at the European Association Awards. Fotis has a business footprint in 15 countries and 5 continents. We will talk about entrepreneurship in the fourth industrial revolution, the hybrid industry, the age of entanglement, disciplined entrepreneurship, the new or future leader, researchers who want to become entrepreneurs, and entrepreneurship in academia. Welcome to the show, Fotis.
Hello, thank you for the invitation.
I must say here that we had a very interesting discussion before we started. And we were talking mainly about how management and businesses perceive innovation compared to what academics or scientific researchers perceive as innovation, like using the word ecosystem, right? In the businesses, it means the economic system, whereas in science, an ecosystem might actually mean the ecology system. And here we see the differences in the terminology. And of course, as we have our discussion, we can distinguish if there are any differences there.
Indeed, we had a very nice warm-up. And I'm a true believer of clarity. That is why I feel that we should start by clarifying the terms in order to make it clear for the audience what innovation is, what it can do for educational institutions and businesses, and how individuals, professionals, and organizations and professional teams can leverage this kind of knowledge, the knowledge of innovation management. There are many definitions, official definitions, that are widely accepted by both the academic and professional community of what innovation is. However, the one that I'm particularly fond of, and I use it all the time, is the official definition of innovation that is used at MIT and developed by the esteemed Professor Bill Ouellette, that innovation equals invention multiplied by commercialization. And it's we have the multiplication factor because it's the product of invention and of commercialization. And why it is the product of those two parameters? Because if you don't have an invention, then you have nothing to commercialize. And so if invention is zero, then you don't have innovation. And on the other hand, if commercialization is zero, if you don't take it to the market, then you don't have innovation. We have an invention sitting on the bench of a research laboratory in a university or a corporate research lab. That is why we need both of those two elements in order to make innovation happen.
Just by reading and listening to your work, what I really liked is that you give also a philosophical undertone, which is not something that one meets really often. For example, I read that you think these days cacophony characterizes the landscape of innovation and entrepreneurship. Why is there a cacophony? People, especially those who plan to begin a business, believe that startups and entrepreneurship thrive.
There is a cacophony, and cacophony is oftentimes the result of something that became popular. The process of popularization usually attracts many individuals, professionals, and so forth. And suddenly they wake up one morning and they baptize themselves as a business expert without any business background or business degree or business whatsoever. I've seen it happening a lot in my environment. People that literally they buy a couple of books, they read it, and the morning after they claim that they are business experts. According to MIT, there is also a crisis, not only a cacophony, but also a crisis on entrepreneurship education and innovation education, which takes the form of abstract storytelling. While the demand for knowledge in this field is growing, at the same time, the supplied quality of this knowledge is not growing as fast. And this gap is usually filled with storytelling. Who did what? Steve Jobs, that started from his garage and he created this amazing company. XYZ entrepreneur who did that and did the other. Storytelling is good in a way that it promotes a positive mindset towards entrepreneurship and innovation. But it is not building the skill set. We need both the mindset, but the skill set. And the skill set, of course, is far more important than spirit. Yes, you do need the spirit, and specifically the spirit of creative irreverence, as they call it. The why not? You know, why shouldn't I change this? Why shouldn't I do that? Why shouldn't I do the other? That's good. But what is going to enable you to do that is skill. That is why I am focusing 100% on building the necessary skills in order to make the vision happen. That is what I mean by cacophony. Storytelling by people who don't possess the necessary official, recognized, curated knowledge in the field of innovation management, technology, whatever your background may be.
Microsoft and Apple have changed the way people see today the digital world. We currently undergo the fourth industrial revolution, which focuses on digital technologies. Mm. In my article on LinkedIn for the fifth industrial revolution, we see that other aspects of the fourth industrial revolution, such as inclusivity, literacy, and citizens' research, became of secondary importance. Such neglect has not been emphasized enough by scientists, researchers, or politicians. How wise is it to focus on novel digital technologies only during the so-called fourth industrial revolution?
Okay, I'm going to start from the end. I like the term so-called. You know, there are conflicting opinions regarding on which revolution we are. According to Jeremy Rifkin, the esteemed professor and author, we are not on the fourth industrial revolution. We're actually on the third industrial revolution. It depends on how, on the parameters that you use in order to clarify or to identify the type of revolution we are. And the economists use three types of parameters. The first one is the energy that you use, the way that you communicate, the technologies that you use to communicate, and transportation technologies. So the first industrial revolution was coal with trains and the telegraph, and then they had the second industrial revolution, which was the telephone, the oil, the internal combustion engine, and now we have the internet as a means of communication, hybrid technologies, clean technologies to move, and a new type, let's say, of communication enabled by sensors that we call the Internet of Things. Therefore, it depends. But for the sake of the discussion, let's agree that we are on the fourth industrial revolution. There will always be a need for a transition, because this is what humanity does. It always transitions from the one state to the other, from the one technology to the other. And of course, this is all identified, this process, in Foster's, for example, models, the S technology curves, or the Rogers innovation adaptation of diffusion and adaptation of the innovations model, which is the most widely accepted model in all the social sciences. So we know that innovations are created and then they are diffused in society till they reach a physical limit, and then we jump to the next technology curve. So there has always been and will always be a need for transition. That is why those that really know, they do not refer to digital transformation as digital transformation, but as digital migration. They just migrate to the enabling technologies in order to be with the times, you know, to move with the times. Digital transformation is something much deeper. It is the actual digitalization of the whole operating system that an organization uses. It is not the adaptation of various digital tools. That's migration. Transformation is when you have a digital core. And that is extremely hard to achieve. That is why most of the change management, projects fail. It is very hard to transition. And by the way, since you are into the PhD sphere, one of the hottest topics and very difficult topics in innovation management, it requires a lot of econometrics, is the research question of how do you shift the core of the business to a new, let's say, state, to a new technology curve. That is extremely hard to do. And there are many cases of successful transition. It depends on the appropriability, the ability of utilizing the knowledge that is generated by the innovation. It's a technical term, a legal term, appropriability, which takes the form of patents, grants, and so forth, licensing, and the complementary assets. The assets that are necessary to capitalize on the knowledge that is generated from the innovation and to translate it into sustainable financial returns.
In 2019, a PwC study found that just 5% of manufacturers in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa are digital champions, compared with 11% in the Americas and 19% in the Asia-Pacific region. Therefore, considered the transition of the industry within the fourth industrial revolution as slow. At the same time, we see a novel industry forming. What is the magic of the hybrid industry?
I'm going to answer first the first part of your question, which is the rate of adaptation. Every type of technology, any type of technology, has a different rate of adaptation, adaption. It depends on the market, it depends on the geography, it depends on politics, on policy, and budgets, of course, because digital transformation requires money, investments. In fact, a global study that I conducted with the participation of more than 1,700 local co-op banks back in 2016, showed that only 11% are willing to pay for digital transformation because they don't have the money or they have other priorities. It's a matter of budgets as well. It is not that easy. And different industries have different rates, different pace of adoption. When they have to, they will do it. As we've seen in one of the leading sectors of technology worldwide, which is agriculture. If you're going to look how the world is going to look like in 20 years, look at agriculture. It's the most advanced. It's food. It's a necessity. We have precision agriculture. We have, for example, robotic medicine. We have intelligent transportations. All of these, at their core, they share a common characteristic that different disciplines, historically distinct disciplines, they come together. We have genomics and big data coming together to form a new type of service, personalized medical care. And this is what we call convergence. We live in the age of convergence, transformation, not digital transformation. That's all. Convergent transformation that opens unique opportunities, fantastic opportunities for science, technology, and business. Look at the Krebs cycle of creativity developed by the esteemed researcher Mary Oxman at the MIT Media Lab, where she describes the relationship of science, engineering, design, and art that used to be separate domains. What happens with the black space that separates them? So we have, and how can they be connected? So science transforms information into knowledge, engineering transforms knowledge into action, and then design comes and transforms that into behaviors, and then art comes and transforms behaviors to new type of thinking, and round we go. So there is a relationship. And now, what's the motivation? As an economist, I'm looking at the motivation behind, you know, all these investments and how the transitions and so forth, because it doesn't mean that a new type of technology will necessarily succeed in the market. Take a look at the virtual reality, for example. It hasn't really taken off. Take a look at augmented reality. It's still there, but not there. Take a look at other cases, more difficult cases to analyze, such as electric cars and conventional cars that are still in the market because they provide a resilience. But that resilience exists because of the infrastructure and the time and the money needed to build the infrastructure for the transition to the electric cars. So we have both technologies. Although we have a ready technology, it's still not there. It's going fast, but not there, because there is the resilience of the previous market. It is chaotic. That is why we need to apply systems thinking, system dynamics, in order to make sense of the world. That is why sense making is considered to be a key skill for the leaders of tomorrow. Sense making, how do you make sense of the world? And of course, to choose the correct course of action. Now, what is the motivation? You know, the lifespan of large companies continues to decline. And the challenge is to identify novel growth opportunities. And those novel growth opportunities, one good way to identify novel growth opportunities through convergent transformation that results into a hybrid industry. For example, look at Google. Google started out as a search engine, then it became a software company on cloud. Now it's an AI company, and now they are also making their own hardware. The same thing with Nike. Nike has been combining product design with data science for years. And Spotify is developing its own smart player for cars. So this is the convergent form of products, as we call it. It creates new opportunities. It opens, you know, a pathway for development. It's an endless topic. That's why I find it addictive.
Augmented reality actually finds applications in security studies and could also find space in education. And of course, we will talk about the future leaders later on. So this convergence takes us to the so-called age of entanglement. Why should the age of entanglement that best addresses the new normality and by new normality, you mean what will follow after the pandemic, focus on new synthesis research by merging existing disciplines to form new ones instead of the multidisciplinary research in the academia now?
The world is becoming more and more complex. The problems are global, they happen fast, and the developments are accelerating. So as humanity progresses, so do the level of complexity of the challenges that require the collaboration of many different types of sciences and disciplines. The matter of need, it is the need and the nature of the need and the nature of the challenge that has created the need for all these different types of disciplines to come together. We were discussing in our warm-up session before the podcast that innovation equals invention by, multiplied by commercialization, meaning that if you don't know how to take the product to the market, you will never succeed, no matter how good engineer you are. So you need to collaborate with someone with a business background. That motivation is generated as the so-called 3H principle. The 3H principle. All teams, what I've learned at the entrepreneurship program at MIT is that innovation requires teams with balance. And by balance, we mean teams that combine the engineering part, the creation part, with the creative part and the business part. And the 3H principle comes from the hacker, hustler, hipster. Hipster is the creative part, meaning in business UX, UI design, marketing, and so forth. Hustler is the business part, the person that actually turns that innovation into business. And of course, the hacker, which is the technical part, the people that create the innovation. So we need balance. So you see that the entanglement is embedded into that philosophy. And not now, it has been here for ages.
You mentioned earlier Spotify developing smart players for cars, Nike combining product design with data science for years, the combination of genomics and big data. Do we have any examples of companies that reinvented themselves through the convergence of science, technology, and entrepreneurship, but at large, infrastructural basis?
Well, there are, if you look at historically, companies that managed to transition. I'm going to tell you a quick story to understand about what makes companies transition successfully. Let's look at the case of the buggy whip makers. Back in the beginning of the previous century, when the first cars started to appear in the market, at the fringes of the wagon market, there was the buggy whip makers. Okay, a small industry that were making buggy whips for the cars. And so when the first cars started to appear, they have experienced a rapid decline into their sales because people were jumping from the horse S-curve to the car S-curve. They tried everything. They tried reducing the prices, all the conventional methods. They reduced the prices. They have increased the advertisements. Spending. They have created new types of products, longer, shorter, different colors, different materials, and so forth. So they did whatever they could, but of course, the industry was dying. So everybody in the end eventually died. Who succeeded? Those that asked two fundamental questions. But behind those two fundamental questions, we have the appropriability and the complementary assets. So behind appropriability is, what is our real expertise? And behind the complementary assets is, why shouldn't we change our product? The real expertise was not to make buggy whips. The real expertise was to work with, they were working with leather. They knew how to work with leather. So those that survived were those that started making leather goods for cars.
a much, much larger market. The same thing didn't happen with the black and white televisions. Most of the black and white television manufacturers managed to transition successfully to the color era because they had the appropriability and the complementary assets were the same, pretty much the same. Just it was a technology push, something different that makes a TV a color TV. The further away you are from your complementary assets and from your appropriability, the things that you know and the things that you can do and the things that you have, the greater the chance of failure. Look at the case of Kodak. People think, again, this is bad storytelling. They said that most people say, if you ask, you know, a lot of people, most of them, they will tell you that they didn't succeed in transitioning to the next technology curve because they didn't invest in digital technology. That is totally wrong. They have invested from the 80s through the 90s for a decade, almost more than 10% of their revenues. That's about $10.5 billion, if I remember correctly, dollars for the digital era. And in an era, in a period that the sales of films were actually growing. So not only they invested, but they invested heavily. And yet they failed. Why did they fail? Because it was a chemicals company. How can you transform a chemicals company into a digital company? You have to fire everybody, about 85%, if I'm not wrong, of the people working at Kodak making films were chemical engineers. And the next technology curve where you needed software engineers. So what do? You fire everybody, and then that is why I said earlier the very difficult equation. How do you move the core from the one technology curve to the other? And then we have new techniques identified by Clayton Christensen, the king of innovation, where you self-disrupt yourself. You're starting an independent organization at the low ends of the market, and you leave it as it is independent. And as long as it is viable, you keep it till it grows and eventually overcomes you. That's the process of self-disrupt. Now, coming to the example that you asked for nowadays, we see a company, for example, that I'm personally fond of is Dropbox. Look at Dropbox. They started as a digital company at their core because it's a cloud storage company. But now they are using this fundamental technology, this enabling technology, to do many other things, such as collaborative workspaces. They have introduced tools like Dropbox Paper, which is fantastic. I'm a big fan of Dropbox Paper. Sharing of files. Transferring of files, and now they have new services like a video capture. So they transition from a mere cloud storage company into a collaborative workspace. Google, the same thing. They started as a search company, and then they became a cloud-based operating system powered by AI later on, and machine learning, and now they also have the hardware. This is how you transition, by identifying opportunities and moving fast. And we have seen also the great failure rates of what they do. You will be amazed if you see how many attempts, products of Google, for example, failed in the market. They're just killing them quickly and using that knowledge and feeding it into new products. Take a look at Google Maps, for example, and Waze. They are using the knowledge gained from Waze and feeding it into Google Maps. So you have to learn by failure. You have to keep learning.
You briefly mentioned who are the best suited for the age of entanglement. So I think that one of those were that one has to be open-minded and curious and relentless. What are the definitions of the open-minded and curious in the age of entanglement?
Mm-hmm. There's actually a definition for that in design thinking. They don't call it open-minded specifically. They don't use this terminology. But they say the prepared mind.
The prepared mind.
So prepared mind equals experimentation, empathy, and open-mindedness. This is what is open-mindedness. Empathy, first of all, to empathize with the customers facing the problem. Of course, this is a philosophy that deals with human-centric problems. It is not how to extract, for example, a chemical from an asteroid. It is human-centered problems. And of course, experimentation. And as I like to say, experimentation is the best type of thinking. You have to move fast, and there is also a relatively new term used in business, initially developed by author Nassim Nicholas Taleb, and later popularized by Bill Olet of MIT, about antifragility. Now we live in a world where things are speeding up, and Bill calls that the law of Trudeau and Sue Siegel, that not only things are moving fast, but they are also accelerating, and they will keep accelerating in the future. We live in a random, often volatile world, and we need to adapt to these changes. But adaptation is not enough. Resilience is not enough. Resilience is being able to absorb the shocks. Antifragility is a far broader and deeper term that encapsulates the ability to absorb the shocks, but also feed on these conditions to grow. So the key question is, how do we develop antifragile professionals, people, kids, and antifragile organizations? How can organizations embed this type of philosophy or, let's say, way of doing things into their operating system? Sense-making is one of them. Speed and agility is the other. Experimentation and always the continuous refinement of things is another. Continuous lifelong learning, definitely. And also the cultivation of a collective sense-making and of a leadership model, it always comes down to leadership, that favors the creation of convergent type of products and services and free flow of information everywhere. So these are pretty much, in a nutshell, the key characteristics of the anti-fragile organization.
Because we have talked quite a lot until now about the future leader, what are the features of the new normality leader, and how can you become one?
As I said, speed, agility, anti-fragility, experimentation, free flow of information, to be an enabler of free flow of information, empowering people to do their job, bringing together people with different disciplines, and creating the environment where convergence can happen and flourish.
Now, my following question is going to sound a little bit philosophical. Could such qualities of the new normality leader be found in one person?
Every leader has a different style. Every leader has a different style. However, what I've learned based on the leadership model by Deborah Ancona taught at MIT is it combines five different elements. The getting things done, the visioning, the connecting and the relating with the world, making sense of the world and relating and connecting people and getting things done. And at the bottom of that model, they have the leadership signature. This is the point where the leader adds their own, let's say, personal signature. It is extremely hard to find all these characteristics in one person, but modern leaders should be trained to have that philosophy to enable this kind of environment. This is something that it can be shared amongst more people rather than looking for that one genius in a million.
So as we go through the pandemic, the economy, including directions in education and research and way of life, change. And by the end of this global public health crisis, we will reach new normality. Disciplined entrepreneurship is, as you have mentioned, an official term that describes the entrepreneurship process developed at MIT.
Disciplined entrepreneurship is a 24-step process that is something much more than a 24-step process. It is actually a huge block of knowledge that completely changes the way you think forever. It's not enough to know the steps and the processes. What you need is research. It is a data-driven methodology. Without data, you cannot run DE24, Discipline Entrepreneurship 24 Steps, and certainly you cannot start the business. Therefore, those advanced methodologies that are used by thousands of MIT startups and by entrepreneurs and teams around the world, it requires the essential skill of primary of conducting primary market research. So imagine that process as a pipe. And through that pipe, there is water. And in our case, is data. So data-driven processes for developing innovations and bringing them to market. It is a process that combines everything from ideation all the way to market development.
What makes then disciplined entrepreneurship having that competitive advantage over existing approaches while transitioning to the new normality?
That is actually an awesome question. It's the core. On every element, on every idea, on every business, on every proposal, whatever I do, I always look at the core element. The core of disciplined entrepreneurship is a technical term that we call, that is called spiraling innovation. So you're starting, spiraling innovation is when you start the innovation from the outer circle with a low fidelity prototype or an idea that can be communicated on a piece of paper or on a software or 3D printed, something that is low fidelity, a low fidelity representation of your idea. And as we move inwards to the center of the spiral, then we have a more refined idea, a more refined prototype. We move into a medium fidelity and then to a high fidelity. We are starting with qualitative methods on the outers, on the outer parts of the spiral in order to explore. And then we end up with quantitative methods in the center in order to investigate and to confirm. That is why, and one of the basic mistakes that I see all the time, again, by people that do not possess the official knowledge, is that, okay, this, you have an idea, fantastic, let's make a business plan, and then why don't you run also a questionnaire? Questionnaire is a quantitative method, it's for confirming, it's not for exploring. That is why it is the last thing that you do. And by the way, business planning, you don't start with a business plan. Business planning is in the middle of the process. It is a method for capturing innovation. First, you have to create it, and then you capture it, and then you deliver it. There are processes. There are boxes. I like thinking inside boxes. It takes time. It takes years to know the boxes that are developed by the academic community because they are researching the entire universe of data universe that is generated by all this research from all these different cases, and then they are categorizing them in order to make sense. That is a fundamental principle of system dynamics.
As the economy changes and the absorption of researchers in academia has already been difficult, many researchers are considering following the entrepreneurial path. For example, one of the aspects we see in my mentoring scheme for PhD applicants, candidates, and doctorates in STEM is how to successfully build a team based on their goals and needs through real case scenarios. What advice would you give to a researcher in STEM who wants to become an entrepreneur without previous business experience?
As I said earlier, it's a completely different ballgame. Conducting research as part of a university or a research lab is one thing. We call that pipeline innovation. It's one of the most basic types of innovation that is not focused on production, and usually the end result is a publication. Now, if they want to transition to entrepreneurship and to make things happen, to commercialize the innovation, they should start testing their innovation, their finding, their technology with the market. And in order to do that, they can do it in collaboration with a team that achieves balance. The creative part, the business part, and of course the technical part. In this case, the creator of the innovation, the finding, the technology, and so forth, is the hacker in this case. As I said, based on the 3H principle. So yes, they should go for it, provided that there is a market, and they should move fast. I had a discussion back in 2019 with a nanotechnology researcher at the Catalan Institute of Nanotechnology and Nanoscience, if I remember the name correctly. An excellent researcher. He told me that he filed for a patent. It took him many years. A friend of his filed for a patent. It took him many years to get it approved. And then he left it. He didn't do anything about it. And then 5 years later, after he completed the process, he decided to take it to the market. And every business said, okay, now it's too late. It's 5-year-old technology. It's very old. So you have to move fast. It doesn't mean that if you patent it, that's the end of the story. There are also other sources of appropriability. Patents is one of them. Brand is another. So they need to acquire this knowledge and, of course, to partner up with people that possess the business side of things. Certainly, they have to go for it, but the terms are different. Now they are creating a product that has to serve a real need. And not all needs are made equal. There are those that are not necessary, we call them caramels. Those that are nice to have, we call them aspirins. And those that are must have, and we call them painkillers. So make sure that your technology, finding, whatever, is a painkiller, is a must have. That's the advice that I have to give.
I'm going to agree with you. It's not necessary and it's impossible for a researcher in science and engineering to, while producing innovation in the lab and making the product ready to get into the market, to speak to customers and research potential markets at the same time, it's much better to form a diverse skills team to achieve a startup's initial steps. We are close to the end of our discussion, Fotis. How could academia foster entrepreneurship?
We don't have to reinvent the wheel. Just look at what the best are doing, that guide the students through the process of taking innovation to markets. So the universities of the future will be global, connected, innovation communities, powered by an organizational design that allows students to connect locally and globally and to co-develop and co-deliver their innovations to the market should they choose to do so, instead of following the traditional path of graduating and then looking for a job. There are alternative ways. Not alternative, I would say other ways, because alternative has a negative connotation to it. Entrepreneurship is not an alternative way.
Entrepreneurship is a career choice.
I agree with you. Thank you, Fotis, for accepting to speak to the Global Greek Influence podcast. I hope you have enjoyed it as much as I have.
Of course. It was an excellent discussion. Thank you for the invitation and an opportunity to talk about, to go deep into these types of subjects that create real impact for society is an opportunity that I will never miss.
Thank you all for staying until the end of this episode, and I will be with you next Sunday. Thank you.